Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo, and those of you that are regular listeners to the show know that I really have a passion for reading. I believe in it very strongly. I myself read 400 to 600 pieces of material a year, books. I review CDs. I review DVDs. It's a passion with me because I believe that reading is a very, very necessary skill, not just being able to read, but to have the comprehension, to understand what you are reading. And all of this comes with training. This is not something that is just going to happen by osmosis. We have to know how to read. We have to be taught how to read. It makes a tremendous difference in your life, economically and in so many other ways. And my guest today, Wayne Brillhart, is a man who has put together an absolutely gorgeous book, and I really mean gorgeous. It's called The Mystery at the Bird Feeder, and he is so passionate about teaching and about encouraging the visual and the auditory side of a child and or even adults to encourage them to love the process of reading, to learn the joy of the adventure of same. So I want to welcome to the show Wayne Brillhart. And Wayne, where are you located?
I am in Heartland, Michigan.
Well, you just have in Heartland, Michigan, an incredible array of natural wildlife, which you go into detail on your book, and I want to go into that in just a little bit. And your book is called The Mystery at the Bird Feeder. But I want to go a little bit into your background, because you're a man that has a passion for teaching, number one, and number two, you really have a passion for empowering literacy in young people, adults too, but you really want to focus on the young. Tell us about your background, and then why do you think that this became such a passion for you?
Well, after graduating from the University of Michigan, I took a position with Los Angeles Unified School District. And while there, I learned a lot about the inner workings of a school system, some of which could bear great improvement. One of the things that I saw when I was, say, an advisor to the Title I schools for mathematics, I learned about many of the reading problems that existed as well while I was in that environment. And at the time, there were at least 20% of the children that were unable to learn to read by the methods they were using. So I took some time off and became director of a reading center for a year to promote reading. And in our reading program, we guaranteed a minimum of one grade level improvement in reading in a 6-week period. The children would come in twice a week for individual tutoring, and in that length of time, there was only one child who was unable to make the one grade level improvement. He did have serious problems and made progress, but on the other end, there was one student who was failing her classes and getting D's and fails. She improved 4 grade levels and became an A and B student, and of course, the teacher and the parents were absolutely elated. But there are a lot of things about reading that if you understand the principles, you can learn rather quickly. And the earlier you begin reading, the better you're going to be at it. I attend craft shows and art shows and promote my book, and I just feel sadly about some of these parents that, oh, we're not interested in books, and they go on about something else. And I feel sorry for their children, because what happened in Los Angeles was that they tried a special program at one time years before judges decreed certain things. Mm-hmm. And Los Angeles experimented by bringing some children that were in a very low achievement school to another area where they were very high achieving students. However, this was third grade, and what they realized is that one group of students had come to school, and when they reached kindergarten, they could count to 10. They knew what an alphabet was. Many of them knew their alphabet. And so when they came to kindergarten and the teacher started talking about things, they already knew some of that, and it was a positive experience which helped them the rest of their career, because they had a positive attitude towards learning, because they were kind of ahead of the game, having learned some things before arriving in school. The other group had not been taught by their parents, and they arrived at kindergarten knowing very little, and so it was up to the teachers to, so to speak, bring the children up to speed and to teach them the very basics of counting and what letters were and how you put them together. And so then we compare these students 3 years later when they're in third grade, and what happened is these students that had a slow start, shall we say, found themselves way behind the students that had had this head start by their parents teaching them all these things at home before they reached kindergarten. And so it caused a lot of problems in the school because the students that were behind academically developed a failure attitude. And they tried to excel at what they could out at the recess, which was fighting. And so the principal wisely brought in some of the local parents to work with these children so that by the end of the year they had had a good positive experience. But I thought it demonstrated the importance of early relationships between parents and their children and teaching them to read. And so from that point on, I had kind of a passion for teaching reading and encouraging reading, even though I happen to be a math and science teacher.
All right, I want to stop there for just a minute, because you've addressed some things that I think are quite significant. Number one, parents that were teaching their children numbers, the alphabet, and this is something that is very, very significant. Children, it's been demonstrated in so many studies how important this is. Other children had not. Their parents, for whatever reasons, had not done this with them. When you had this demonstration and the teachers were required, obviously, a child comes in, that's part of their job, to teach the child. And they would be using a system, and those children, depending on how that teacher was able to interact with them, would have an effect. But by having that personalized attention, by having other parents come in and working with these children, then the playing field leveled out. And I think that that is significant. I think that children are like sponges. They really soak up anything and everything around them, good, bad, mm-hmm. or indifferent. That's just what they are, because they use we, the adults, as examples. In your material regarding teaching, you made some comments that I thought were very significant, and I related to them personally. because I know what I went through when I was in school, and I was considered an above-average student. But I can remember actually flunking a course because I couldn't understand the teacher. The teacher, the way the teacher was teaching, it just didn't work. You talk about the lecture method. That is something that never worked for me, ever. I can listen to lectures, but I have to write, I have to be involved, I have to do something, and I'm sure many of my listeners feel the same way. Visual is very important, and we all learn in our own unique way. You say if you have gifted students that are so bright, I mean, they just pick up on stuff, and man, they're ready to rock and roll. They're ready to go on. You say slow, deliberate explanations may not work with them because their brains, they just require a different pace. It's just who they are. And this has always been the case with kids. I mean, I find that it is really fascinating that people seem to think that the kids of today are so different from the kids of yesterday. I think the technology today is different, but I think kids are kids. I think you're going to have those that are going to learn in different ways and different manners. And also you bring up something that I think is important. You said a student may appear to not be paying attention, but he has answers when you ask him the questions. His attention patterning may be different, but he's hearing what you're saying. He's absorbing information. And then they get restless because they already figured things out. They don't want to sit still, especially
right.
Boys. That's nothing unusual either. So, you know, I think sometimes we get so far removed from the actuality of kids that are kids, and they are going to be different. And I think good teachers I've ever known, they say, all right, let's check some things out here. What have I got here? Maybe I'm not the one to work with this kid, but somebody else can. Because of this experience that you had in the Los Angeles school system, you decided that you wanted to develop something, and you call it the CAMIL, C-A-M-I-L methodology. And this would work for adults that are not able to read. And sadly, we have too many of them. We have too many people as adults that are not willing to read. But you say getting kids involved, it's just absolutely wonderful. But with some kids, you have to work with them longer. It's just the way they learn. It's going to take repetition. It's going to take a number of things to finally get them to that point where they go, woohoo, I got it. So let's talk about your technique, curiosity, attention, motivation, involvement, and learning. Let's
yes.
go into that.
Okay, I like to start backwards. For those that are dyslexic, they might be more comfortable, but starting with the L, the objective is to get the students to learn. And in order to get them to learn, we need to get them involved. And getting them involved means getting them motivated. We need to get them moving and doing. And to get that, you need attention. And every teacher knows that you have to have attention in order for learning to take place. And so in our CAMIL approach to learning, the C stands for curiosity. And I encourage teachers to have two lesson plans. One lesson plan is what do you want them to learn? And then the second one is how are you going to trick them into it? Students tend to be curious, and if we can come up with some kind of a curious way to get their attention, then we're on our way to get them to learn something. And so a lot of times what you have to present to the students is not necessarily what you want them to learn. It's a way to get them to learn what you want them to learn, if that's not too much double talk. So we create an atmosphere of curiosity or mystery, and we want to solve something. And in the process, we discuss the things that need to be learned by the student so that they pick it up on the way along the journey. And Donna, as you mentioned, there's differences in how students learn. Some take longer, some get it right away. And I think too often, students are labeled as troublemakers or lacking in intelligence, when in fact they may be gifted and they learn this stuff so fast that They're uncomfortable. They can't sit still because you're not feeding them enough information fast enough. They want more information, and since you're not giving it, then they're looking out the window thinking about something else or watching somebody else. And they're not always troublemakers. They're the kinds of people that they just need more information. And one of the tricks that's been successful in the past, since you mentioned students are sponges, is you give them additional assignments and offer them extra credit and keep them busy with an extra load. And many times, if they're truly gifted, they're going to enjoy that. They're going to take it on as a challenge. They don't care that they have twice as much work as everybody else because they're learning and it's an enjoyable experience.
Wayne, let me just stop there for just a minute because I want to bring out something that was brought to my attention a number of years ago. A technique that was used by one-room school teachers, and many teachers like to employ this, is that when you have extra bright students, that you encourage them to teach younger students or those students that are having trouble, and it involves them in a whole different level. I have a very dear friend whose son is just brilliant, absolutely brilliant, and wisely, and this was in music and some other things, he was encouraged. He was so adept in learning. He just shined like a star. He was just wonderful. And they wanted him to understand a level of responsibility, and so they encouraged him to teach the younger kids. And what that did, that taught him the discipline of communicating and his patience level. This young man has just blossomed, and every week, he goes in and works with children, younger kids. He is now going to be 16 years of age. He's been doing this for 5 years. And his communication skills have just exploded, absolutely exploded. They are wonderful. He is just an incredible person. He's turning into this phenomenal human being that is just as comfortable with his adults, his own peers, as well as little ones.
Yes, one of my grandchildren had that experience. He was so far ahead in math, and it was so easy, the teacher let him teach class from time to time because he was very good at explaining it to the other students. And so the wise teacher will pick up on these things and try to steer all this extra energy in a constructive direction so that it's not wasted in trying to keep somebody sitting still when they aren't going to be able to do it.
Right. Now, the motivation, getting involved, all of that, that is what your book is about. Your book, Mystery at the Bird Feeder, is the first in a series. And when I saw your book, the photography in it is just beautiful. And
thank
I'm
you.
Sure you've taken these photographs in your own natural environment there in Michigan. And just the visual for this is going to grasp anyone's mind, young or old. It's absolutely gorgeous. And I don't know, you've got this bird on a branch that's on the cover of your book, Wayne. I don't know what the species is, but it has this beautiful red on its head and reminds me in a way of a woodpecker. But the woodpeckers here in the Pacific Northwest are nowhere as colorful as this bird. And this photo was taken in winter, and it has speckled colors on its wing, and it's just sitting there. What made you decide with your book of The Mystery at the Bird Feeder to employ nature as your part of the instructional process?
Well, Donna, first of all, that's a red-bellied woodpecker.
Oh, it is a woodpecker.
Yes, it is.
Oh, for heaven's sakes.
The red-headed woodpecker has a completely red head, and so they couldn't call this one a red-headed woodpecker, even though half of its head is red. But it does have a little red on its belly, so I guess that's why they named it the red-bellied woodpecker. But this happens to be a female, and the difference is that with the male, the red comes a little bit further around to its beak on the top of its head. But you were right, that is a woodpecker. And the story evolved when I had just recently received a lens from a friend of mine who had picked up a bunch of camera lenses at a garage sale, and he gave me the Minolta lenses because he didn't want them, and one of them happened to be a really good telephoto lens. So I was enjoying shooting the birds through my dining room window, and along come some deer. And when I got my photographs developed, because at that time I was still insisting on film, I hadn't been convinced digital photography was the quality of film, I found this one photograph with the tongue of the deer inside the bird feeder, and I said, we have to make a story of this. Mm-hmm. And then a couple days later, the bird feeder was on the ground empty, and I said, there's the plot. Mm-hmm. And I spent the rest of that winter taking photographs of the birds to put the story together. And one of the things about the book is by using the photographs, I'm hoping it will lend to the reality. There's so much reality show going on right now that hopefully these photographs will bring a little reality and say, hey, this is nature and nature is great. Let's get outside and enjoy nature a little more, encouraging these children to become involved with watching the birds and listening to them. Birding is right now the fastest growing sport in America.
Amazing.
And so by encouraging students to get involved, in this case, in the story, to learn about the birds while they're trying to solve the mystery as to who knocked that bird feeder down and ate all the bird seed, by the time they find out, they've come across 8 different birds, and hopefully we'll be able to recognize them outside and will hopefully be motivated to go outside and watch and listen to the birds.
You know, Wayne, you bring up so many good points. One of the things that I get so weary about hearing is talking about childhood obesity. Our society has gotten to a point where there is this lesser amount of opportunity because of all kinds of fears of children being out in the natural environment. My goodness, our pioneers, forefathers and foremothers would just be appalled at the way things are done now. Everything is so insulated. And that's something that brings an arena of just amazing insight into kids to be able to go out, to be out in the cold, be out in the sun, you know, be outside, getting dirty. All of these things are so important. This is something that kids used to do. Moms used to toss them out of the house and say, go play, don't come home till sundown, because we didn't have mm-hmm. televisions and things like this around that kept kids occupied at that time of history. So they had to be innovative. And I think of family members that I talked to that they came from large families, some of them, and they said, when we were growing up, we couldn't say, gee whiz, I'm bored. If we did, our parents would say, well, you have a choice. Either go get a book and read, or you're going to find yourself cleaning the floor. Which one would you rather do? So guess which one they chose. Anyhow, there was an involvement, and it was time to daydream. You didn't have things going all the time where you could not see, smell, feel, taste, touch in the natural environment. And I think that's where organizations like the Scouts and so Boys and Girls Club of America, so many different groups like this, adults will take them out. They'll have a chance to camp, to hike, to do all of these things and be exposed to a world away from the computer. Because if you don't have mm-hmm. this in your life, how is your creative side going to develop? And that's one of the gifts that your book gives. Now, I love Purdy, your English setter. I think Purdy is absolutely adorable. And you have a photograph of Purdy here sitting on the top of his doghouse. And mind you, friends, the doghouse is covered with snow. So this English setter is up on top of this doghouse watching. But the photography is just fabulous. And you talked about how your granddaughter, Laura, came up with the title, The Mystery at the Bird Feeder. How old was she when she came up with the title?
Let's see. 9 from that happened in 2009. She's just turned 13, so I guess she was around 9 or 10 back then.
Well, and she made a good choice. She did a good job because it sets the stage for the beauty of your book. And your photographs of the deer, who is the thief, And the way the story flows, all of the different birds that you bring in and the theme of the story with the birds and them talking, there's just so much here. And then, of course, the bird feeder on the ground with the mystery of who invaded it. All of this would be very tantalizing for children. What's the age grouping for this book?
Well, I think the main target would be around third grade. There was a third grade teacher that thought it was the perfect book for her class and wrote a very nice recommendation for the jacket of the book. But I would say fourth grade on down, because at the craft shows there are times when I'll read the book to mom and dad and baby, and once in a while those babies just love those photographs. So I tell the parents, make up the story on your own until she's old enough to understand, but let her look at the photographs. That gets them interested in nature from an early age.
Well, not only that, but something that has been discovered with babies. One, they understand a lot more than what we give them credit for. And there has been research done by different parties that even before a toddler starts toddling securely on its feet, it's just rambling around, you talk to that child, and if you have photos that you've shown the child or pictures, let's say of a rhinoceros, an elephant, a deer, whatever it is, you ask them to point it out, they'll point it out. They recognize things. So this is something that with children that really, if they are taught at a young age, and I know, Wayne Brillhart, this is something that's a very strong passion of yours. And for those of you listening, I think the love of learning begins with children when they're very small. If you, as an adult, have a passion for learning, it is going to open up worlds for children. And one of the best ways, yes, I know we have video, I know we have all of these things, but one of the best ways is for them to hold in their small hands a book. And I'll tell you, I know people say books are going to be out of style eventually. I don't think so. I know we're going into the electronic age, but there is a magic about finding that little niche or cranny that you can crawl into. Maybe if you're young enough and you can climb a tree, you climb up in the tree, but there's a place for you and that book, and it's sort of a sacred spot where you can immerse yourself in a world that's wonderful. And this book, The Mystery at the Bird Feeder, does exactly that. You and a child, or even an adult that is learning how to read, enters a world of magic through the beauty of Wayne's photography, through all of the birds, the natural environment that he has here, and the beautiful mystery that is in place. Wayne, you have, I know we're just about out of time here, you have a website that people can go to, thebirdbooks.com, thebirdbooks.com. They'll find out about The Mystery at the Bird Feeder. You also have a soft cover of this book that's available on Amazon.com. Is that correct?
Yes.
Well, I just think that this is so incredibly beautiful that young and old will delight in it. And in the back of the book, there's information on all of the birds that he's taken pictures of. I had no idea that this was becoming so positive. In fact, the teacher in your book says, we were getting ready for a great backyard bird count. I was thinking my classroom needed a story that had different birds in it. The week we were going to count the birds before the week, before we were to count the birds and submit our citizen scientist data to the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, my daughter lent me this book. It's just what we needed. My students enjoyed the story and could identify all the birds in it. It's a perfect addition to my nature watching classroom. And that's Sue Beth Balash, and she said loved the photograph. Wayne, you've done an incredible job. Thank you so much for being my guest today.
Thank you, Donna. I appreciated being with you.
This is Donna Sebo. We're going to be taking a break. If you want something in your library that you can pull out for your grandkids, your own children, or if you know of someone that needs to learn how to read that's an adult, this is a book I could highly recommend. The Mystery at the Bird Feeder by Wayne L. Brillhart. And that's spelled B-R-I-L-L-H-A-R-T. Check out his website, thebirdbooks.com. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break, and we're going to be back in just a moment.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you. We offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone lines are now open. And if you'd like to call in, I'd be delighted to light your life up with a little bit of intuitive insight. If you're a new listener, all I need from you is your first name or your initial. And then after that, let me tell you what I perceive, and then you're welcome to ask a question about anything that might be of importance to you. Well, I have a lot of little odds and ends that I wanted to share with you today, including a spooky story. So why don't I start out with that? I just love these unusual situations that have been recorded historically because it always points out we don't have all the answers, nor will we ever. And to me, that is exciting because it gives us the opportunity to question. And my guest earlier was just, you know, he's very passionate about teaching, about education. And I am too. Because I was an avid reader when I was quite small. In fact, I was reading by the time I was 4. Now, there was no one else in my family that had a passion for books the way I do. And I have no reason why I came in with that. But it was something I can remember when I was very small, when I was reading information in a newspaper. And I was remembering all of this. I can still see the newspaper in my head today, and I don't have a photographic memory. But it was about a man that had been inside of a woman's apartment and was behind it, and she was attacked. Well, we hear all kinds of stories like that today, but I remember in my young mind, by golly, you better have the front porch light on and this, that, or the other. Little points that were expressed when I was little in that article stayed with me. And it's fascinating how we absorb different points of information. And I learned in later years that I actually had a mild case of dyslexia. What did I know? Well, when I was growing up, that's just the way it was. There wasn't a term. There wasn't anything that gave information about this particular problem that people can have in schools that can cause challenges. Well, there's a lot of people that go through life, some people extremely famous, that later on, they, when they're really old and gray, they say, well, I had this problem, and I had that problem, and I had the other problem. And somehow they managed to get through it. In many ways, we're very fortunate today because we've learned about this. I have a very good friend who has a daughter who is a severe dyslexic. And what they had to learn was how to reach her thinking processes. And by golly, she graduated from college. She is brilliant. She is absolutely awesome in the creative aspect of life. And she's just done an incredible job. She's just amazing, absolutely amazing. So these are things, sometimes we come in with challenges in life, but that doesn't mean we can't accomplish, we can't do. So if you have a child, if you know of an adult that maybe has particular problems with learning, we don't dumb down. Set the standards high. Expect them to be able to reach for the best part of themselves. As adults, that's what we need to remember about ourselves as well. If you have challenges in certain areas of learning, okay, so maybe hire a tutor or figure out a way that you can utilize your skills of mind so you can be the best you can be. And reading is an absolutely vital situation that must be learned, because you're going to have problems with contracts, you're going to have problems with all kinds of things if you can't read. And it is something I've seen more than once. And I think one of the saddest stories I ever experienced, and I mean really experienced, was sitting with a gentleman who was almost 90 years old. This man was absolutely brilliant when it came to working with construction. He had he was a black man that had come up from the South, never learned to read. I met his family, and his family told me about his accomplishments and how for so many years, not even members of the family, his wife knew, but not even members of his own family knew, he could not read. He was so good at what he did, people tried to promote him. He never accepted the promotion. And the reason he could not accept the promotion, they did not know he couldn't read the papers that information had to be posted on. It was really a sad state. And I looked at him, I remember talking with him, and said, you know, you can learn to read, even though you're 89 years of age. His children, his grandchildren, I met, and they said, it's so embarrassing to him that he won't even try it. When they finally learned about it, he was in his 70s, I believe. And there were some things that they had to take care of that he could no longer hide the fact he could not read from his own family. He was dearly loved, but this wonderful man missed out on opportunities because he couldn't read. So if you know of anyone that has this need, check out the libraries, check out whatever you can. It makes a difference. I want to share a story with you called Sucked into the Abyss. By the way, if you want to give me a buzz, 888-627-6008. Now, this took place on December the 9th, 1873. It took place in England, Bristol, England. There's something about that part of the world, I don't know what it is, but just about everybody I've ever met from England has a story to tell. It's either something that's happened to members of their family, or it's part of the history of the place that they live in, or, you know, many other circumstances. Well, there was a gentleman by the name of Thomas Cumston. He and his wife, they were elderly. This one night, they were running through the streets of Bristol in their pajamas. She in her nightgown. They were in a total panic. The husband was shooting a pistol. They ran into the railway station in Bristol, and Mr. Cumston said, my wife and I have escaped from a den of thieves and rogues. Well, remember, this is the 1800s. People running through the street in their pajamas and nightgowns, they thought you were a little nuts. Well, in court the next day, yes, they put him in court the very next day, Mr. Cumston was still so agitated. And everything he was saying, I said, oh, this man is totally delusional. Now, this is what happened to them. They had checked into the Victoria Hotel that night before, and they were awakened during the night by some real strange noises. These noises were so different, it scared them badly. The landlady of the hotel heard these indescribable sounds, ignored them, told the couple, because this couple was very frightened, said, oh, don't worry about it. Just go back to bed. You're fine. At 3 a.m., these sounds came back, along with this feeling that the ground of the hotel was giving way. They felt this in their room. They felt it with the whole hotel. Well, of course, Mr. Cumston, he got out of bed as quickly as he could, and this is what his story was. The floor of the room that they were staying in was opening up, and an unknown force was dragging him into a black void. Mrs. Cumston obviously was awake because her husband was crying out. She saw her husband disappearing into this black void and got a hold of him and dragged him out. There were invisible voices they heard. They were just making tremendous noise. Well, that's when this couple jumped out the window of their hotel room and ran away. They were looking for help. Now, the police investigated the room, couldn't find anything unusual. So they said this was a collective hallucination. This very distressed couple was turned over into the custody of friends. Again, they were told they were delusional. This is a story that took place in December 1926 in Corpus Christi, Texas. Four students entered a supposedly haunted college dorm room. Something that was vaguely visible, you were aware of it, was in this room. When they entered this haunted room, remember, this room had a reputation. One of the students was grasped by a force that felt like a very powerful magnet, and he was literally pulled away from his friends. They reached for him again, grabbed onto him, and fought furiously to keep them in their grasp. Other students heard the commotion, were outside of this room, but they couldn't open the door. What they did, they finally ripped out the oak paneling to gain the entrance into the room. When that happened, those students that were inside holding onto their companion, the energy disappeared. A little spooky? Sound like a Stephen King special? Mm-hmm. You betcha. Just thought I would share with you that little bit of paranormal experience. We never know. Lots of things go on. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Now, tomorrow, I am doing a speaking engagement at the Chamber of Commerce, so I'm not going to be here, but we are going to be replaying a program that I did last week with Frank Joseph about the lost world in America. If you missed that show, you must listen. Here in the United States, we have history that is being discovered that I think is absolutely amazing about cultures, people from around the world, artifacts, the snake mounds, all of this you'll find out about in the interview. Well, it's getting close to summertime. Airports are packed. We've just got people anxious and eager to get out and about and away. Here in the Pacific Northwest, SeaTac Airport, it is seemingly wall-to-wall people. And some schools let out early, but people are ready to move into the excitement of the summer months and traveling. And you just have to be aware, when you go to the airports, be prepared. Dress comfortably so it's easy to get out of your shoes, and try to be thoughtful with your packing, because they really are becoming very, very, at least at the SeaTac airport and the other airports that I've experienced going to New York, being in Chicago and in other places in my travels. Be aware, they do have these scan units, and if you have anything in your pockets, et cetera, they're going to pick up on it. And you may end up getting patted down. So be alert and be aware. But what if you're trying to figure out, I'd like to go to someplace different this year. I'd like to have an experience that I've never had before. Well, how about Bayo Canyon, New Mexico? Yeah, you could go there and explore atomic artifacts. You know, in 1952, there was an atomic bomb that was blown up. And it took place in the deserts in the Southwest. And there's all kinds of fascinating places that you can go to. Now, this is 3 miles east of Los Alamos, and it lies between two volcanic mesas. And there, the U.S. military perfected the implosion mechanism used in the Fat Man bomb that was detonated over Nagasaki, Japan, in 1945. Now, you might not think there's too much going on there, but by golly, if you're interested in taking home a piece of the Manhattan Project, you're going to be able to do that. Most of the items are not radioactive, but there's a lot of stuff that is available, and they don't mind people picking it up, but don't touch the native artifacts if you happen to find any. They don't like you to do that. But there's a National Museum of Nuclear Science and History in Albuquerque, which is close by, and there's also a site, it's a government-run Sandia National Lab, where in 1957 a bomber accidentally dropped a mammoth Mark 17 hydrogen bomb, and you can go out and look for stuff. So if you're wanting something that's a bit unusual, check it out. You might find something that nobody ever thought was left there. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to be taking a break for a moment here. When we come back, I have got a recipe for no-bake red, white, and blue cheesecake cupcakes. And by the way, these are low-cal. And if you've got a sweet tooth like I have, that is something that's good news. So I'll be sharing that with you and some other items as well. Give me a buzz if you want to chat, though, 888-627-6008. We'll be right back.
Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believed in? Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Toprosin is a homeopathic cream that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.toprosin.com. That's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N. And find out more information. You can order Toprosin online or call 800-959-1007. That's 800-959-1007. Be sure to give them the code DS30 and you'll receive a 30% discount. Toprosin, non-toxic, safe for children too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. This cheesecake recipe is so nice. Now, you know what? With summer months coming up, you're going to be doing some entertaining. How about a dessert? One that's time-effective to fix, has a wonderful eye appeal, and you could decorate this in different ways than I'm going to suggest. But two, it's going to taste good, and you have individual servings. And if you're like me and you get a craving for something sweet and you want something different, cheesecake is one of my favorites. Of course, we all know you don't want to end up looking like a cheesecake, but you want to be able to enjoy it. And this is great. Now, what this is going to utilize is fresh berries, which are just out and about now. Your blueberries and your strawberries. We're going to have so many of them. Here in the Pacific Northwest, one of my favorite things to do is to pick fresh blackberries. And we have blackberry bushes all over the place around where I am in the Pacific Northwest. And, boy, I go out with my little plastic bucket and pick those up. And then I freeze them, and sometimes I put them in the freezer, or I make my preserves, which I dearly love, or syrups for wintertime because, you know, they're just seasonal items, and, boy, it's just wonderful to fix them. Let me give you this recipe. It's really, really quick. Two-thirds of a cup of crushed graham crackers. Two-thirds of a cup of crushed graham crackers. Remember, this is going to be low-cal. 2 tablespoons of granulated no-calorie sweetener. That's equivalent to 3 packets. You might want to try stevia with this. If you don't want to use any artificial sweeteners, you can get the packets of stevia. And stevia is a wonderful item to put in. You're going to need 3 tablespoons of butter melted. It won't make any difference whether you use unsalted butter or salted. You're going to need an 8-ounce tub style of reduced fat cream cheese. That's right, 8 ounces of that, reduced fat cream cheese. You're going to need 8 ounces of fat-free cream cheese. And the cream cheese needs to be at room temperature, so you might want to put it out the night before. If you're like me, you're lazy, you want everything ready as soon as you start working on it. A third of a cup of granulated no-calorie sweetener, and that's equivalent to 8 packets. Again, try stevia with this if you want to try it out. It's sometimes a good thing to try it out first to see if you really like it with a stevia, because stevia gives a different flavor than, let's say, Splenda and some of the other sweeteners. It really is important to try it. Then you want 1/2 cup of light sour cream, and there is no fat sour cream, but having the light sour cream gives this just a little bit better taste. 1 cup of light whipped topping, and then you need 1/4 teaspoon of almond extract. You need 1 cup of blueberries, 6 medium strawberries, and the strawberries should be stemmed and halved. And this is what this does. You could substitute other berries. You could do a number of things with this. You're going to have 12 muffin cups. You want to put them in their cupcake holders, and you want to lightly coat the liners with your nonstick cooking spray. That's so the cheesecake will release easily. Then in a medium bowl, you're going to mix your cracker crumbs, 2 tablespoons of sweetener, and your butter, and then you want to press 1 rounded tablespoon into the bottom of each of your muffin cups. And what you want to do, you want to chill it for 15 minutes. So you don't bring it up on the sides of the muffin cups. You just press it down in the bottom. Now, you put that, while that's chilling, you go in a medium bowl with your mixer on low speed. You want to beat your cream cheeses, 1/3 cup of your sweetener, and your sour cream until it's just real smooth. No lumps here. You want it really, really smooth. And then you want to beat in by hand. Or you could use your mixer on low speed, 1/2 cup of your whipped topping and your almond extract. And then you fold in the remaining topping. And then you take your cheesecake filling, because it's going to be about 15 minutes. It will have been in the cheesecake crust, will have chilled in the refrigerator. And you spoon your cheesecake filling into your crust, and you want to make the tops smooth. And you take a strawberry half, put it in the center of each cheesecake, and put your blueberries around the strawberry, and chill it until set. That could be 2 hours. You could do this the night before. If you're going to have a gathering, and your dessert will be right there, ready to go. It is so light, and it is so easy. Now, maybe you're not into berries. Great. If you don't want berries, figure something else out that you could put on that would be a little different. This is a basic cheesecake recipe, and you might want to try a little bit of lemon curd. Now, that's going to add calories, but hey, you know, whatever you want to do. This kind of a recipe can be adapted in many, many ways. Maybe you want to put chocolate sprinkles on it or something like this. So anyway, I just thought I would share that with you. Oh, quickly, I want to remind you that on Thursday, I've told you that tomorrow we're going to be talking about the Lost Worlds of America, but on Thursday, we're going to be talking baseball. Now, I'm not a sports person, but let me tell you, this book, Shipwrecked, A People's History of the Seattle Mariners, was a big eye-opener for me because I'm in the Seattle area. This is a team that has had quite a history, but we are going to be talking about baseball and the business of baseball, and John Wells is going to be my guest. And then, on Friday, Quantum Thinking. Diane Collins is going to be my guest. This is a woman that really believes in empowering people. And how can we empower ourselves? Well, listen in on Friday and you'll find out. Don't forget, you can check the website, BBS Radio, The Donna Sebo Show. You can check in there and you'll find all the information about my guests that are coming up. So just check it out if you want to know who's appearing, what they're doing, and sort of a general idea of what we are going to be talking about. Now, you know, I was just talking about cupcakes and cheesecake cupcakes. Well, I have to tell you, I have more fun with all the material that crosses my desk, finding out about studies that people do. Well, guess what, ladies and gentlemen? We now have a study on cupcakes, and the type of cupcakes you eat determine your personality. Okay, so what are we going to say about your cupcake personality? Well, I have to tell you, I'm not into cupcakes too much myself, so I guess I just don't count. But this is what two delightful women, Sophie and Catherine, decided that they had to do, because cupcakes are their business. They did an analysis of their customer personalities, so this is what it is. Vanilla, vanilla, vanilla. Traditional. That is your personality type, and they said this vanilla cupcake is for those that like something sweet but don't want to get too crazy. However, if you do choose a vanilla cupcake with chocolate frosting, you're open to risk-taking. Aha! If you're chocolate, yes, how many of us love that delightful, delightful item? Chocolate, well, it means you're an intense personality. Maybe they do know something about me. Okay, the analysis, this is for people who are serious and focused, and if you get a chocolate cupcake with chocolate frosting, it's usually preferred by deep thinkers. Mm-hmm. Apparently, vanilla frosting lovers are slightly less intense. Carrot, if you like your carrot cupcakes, you're practical. A carrot cake lover makes decisions from a common sense standpoint. Here you're getting vegetables with your treat. I thought we liked carrot cupcakes just because they tasted yummy. Well, guess what? We have gone forward with new information. Peanut butter fudge. That is a good combination. We know of a few candies that would have that. Adventurous is your personality. If you choose a rich, messy, over-the-top flavor, it shows you jump into new activities. Freak first, and there's no hesitation or worrying. Lemon, berry, you're spunky. Those people drawn to bright frostings and flavors and tends to embrace life in the most colorful way. They're always fun to be around. And last but not least, red velvet. You're a romantic soul. The first choice of anyone in a lovely, dovey mood, from deep red hue of the cupcake to the little heart they put on their cupcake, which has white frosting. It's one you want to share with that special someone. Well, we're out of time, ladies and gentlemen. You know about your cupcakes, and you know what your personality style is. Now go out and enjoy life with a vim, vigor, and zest that is your rightful heritage. Life is a joy. Learning is a joy. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. God bless. Have a magnificent day, wherever you might be. And we'll be back with you again tomorrow, same time, same place, right here at bbsradio.com. Donna Sebo here. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.